get on the network. In fact, you can have an Echolink QSO that's RF-less, if you will, by connecting to either another station or a reflector. And I'm not suggesting that's a good thing either. It is half duplex. So imagine it's a little like, if you're using a computer, it's sort of like half duplex Skype.
Yeah, it sounds like your push-to-talk mic is occasionally sticking a little bit. The technical net that Gordon, W2TTT, is associated with at BARA, Bergen Amateur Radio Association, are recorded at the website that this technet is also recorded at, and that's amateurradio.tv. That's www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And you can listen to the past recordings of the BARA technical net from New Jersey, as well as the Limark technical net from Long Island. And sounds like you've been using IRLP and Echolink for a while, Gordon. I haven't gotten involved in that yet. I'm a little light on computers. I'm looking at your website right now. I see your picture, and it looks to me like you were doing some hiking at the time the picture was taken. Okay, I think we're finished for tonight. You guys just listen to, let me drop.
Yeah, can I just call Mel for 1 second?
Yeah, go ahead.
W2KEY, WB2HWW.
Go ahead, Howie.
Listen, if you can, you give me a call maybe tomorrow or whenever you get a chance. I misplaced your phone number and I wanted to give you a call. Do you have my number or do you want me to tell you it again?
I'm sure I have it in the index. Yeah, all right, I'll get home tomorrow, get a chance. I'll give you a call, Howie, and we can have a discussion. I know what you want to talk about most likely, so I get a chance tomorrow. I'll make a note of it, Howie, over.
Because I know you don't want to give your phone number over the air. I just want to say hello. I'm going to ask you a favor, but no big deal. Because the last time we had a nice conversation on the phone, if you remember.
Roger. Okay. I should be home. Let's see. Tomorrow's Monday night. Try to get home around reasonable time, so got a bit of work tomorrow. Okay. We'll catch up with you tomorrow, Howie.
You call me anytime. I don't go to sleep till like 11, 12 o'clock. No problem. Thank you, Dick, K2RIW. Dick, before you end the TechNet, I just want to ask you something. We were talking about dipoles and inverted Vs. Does it matter if it's an inverted V or a dipole about how far above? We know that a dipole for low-angle radiation should be a half-wave length above the ground. Does it make a difference if the antenna is an inverted V? Does the inverted V have to be any more or less above the ground to get the best performance?
I'm not positive on this one, Howie, but I think the answer is almost no. In other words, the apex of the inverted V is the part that's high enough above the ground. I think the electronic phase center of an inverted V antenna is very close to that apex. It's a little bit below the apex, but not a whole lot. Now, this is based on the philosophy that the beginning of the radiation happens as the magnetic field is coming out of the antenna. The magnetic field is maximum where the current is maximum. The current is maximum at the center. And all of your computer programs work on that philosophy. They carefully calculate all the currents flowing through every little subset of the antenna and add up all those magnetic fields. So if that computer modeling program, which is very popular, is accurate, let me drop. That would suggest that whether you make the dipole out straight or as an inverted V with a reasonable V angle, then I think the electronic altitude is very similar. And the only major problem you've got with an inverted V is that if the tips come very close to other objects, then you get a little bit of a lowering of the frequency because of capacitance adding to the ends. But that's a very easy job to retune. Also, earlier, I think Mel or somebody was mentioning that the pipes and wiring and conduits that you've got in the house represent metallic objects that are under the antenna. If, for instance, you're putting the dipole above the roof of the house. Most of the time, I believe those metallic objects in the house are primarily transparent. Yes, If you had a flat roof that's metallic, you've got this great big metallic sheet underneath the antenna. But by the time you get the pipes and conduits, there's very little material there, wavelength-wise, based on the assumption that none of those pieces of pipe just happened to hit resonance. Your 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire that's 132 feet long only casts a shadow on the ground of a couple of square inches. But when it hits resonance, that piece of wire gets an electronic area of 8,500 square feet. And that's real. And you can measure that. So it goes from 1,500 square feet down to less than 1 square foot when it's out of resonance. And that's electronic resonance that you can establish with an antenna tuner. So by the same token, all those pipes and wiring in the house, most of the time, are almost completely transparent in my mind, unless they happen to hit resonance. So I think that'll help. I think there's been some experiments that'll confirm that. That's a strongly felt philosophy. I'm not absolutely positive it's right, but we'll eventually confirm that. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1302 of the series that began in September of 1982. Mel and I, as long as we stay healthy, we intend to be back next week and doing more of this, run more of these electronic classes, as I started calling them last week. And it's the gathering of the clan in which we share information. 73, you all, try to be kind to each other. Enjoy the field day next weekend. Try to visit a couple of the field day sites. I have intention of dropping in on Kings County Radio Club again and seeing how this guy Mel is doing. I'm going to check in on him. KQKUI, you got it, Mel. Thank you. KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2QAQ with a comment for Howie.
Yeah, hold on. Let Mel go first, and then we'll go over to Howie. You got it, Mel. Very fine, Gordon. You got it, Mel.
Okay, very good, Dick. Look forward to seeing you, and yeah, maybe we can spend the night together, as we've done in the past. And basically, quick comment on inverted V. Yeah, it will have somewhat of a different pattern than a dipole. The pattern is somewhat altered from a regular horizontal dipole. Other than that, it one support works quite well. As long as you keep the V at no less than 90 degrees, it will perform excellent. So that's about all on inverted V. 73 is all, everybody. Enjoy field day. Be careful. Whatever the heck you guys are doing, please, I don't want to hear about any more catastrophes from field day. Be careful. You're working with generators. They can... You're working with antennas up there, roots, climbing trees, or whatever the heck you guys are doing. Be careful. And especially if we do have any storms coming up, lightning or anything like that, make sure that antennas, everything is disconnected and you're not doing any antenna work with when there's lightning present. 73 is all. Talk to you next week. K2KEY, good night.
Yeah, the safety requirements are a beautiful one, something to really consider. The thing that scares the daylights out of me as a guy who's owned 100 feet of tower ever since 1967 or so, 66, is that many of these field day sites, people use what I call temporary guying made out of polypropylene rope and nylon rope into very simple stakes in the ground. Worry about the fact if somebody trips over one of those stakes, and if those stakes are really not rammed into very solid material, and if somebody trips over one of those and yanks up a stake, and a 40 feet of steel tower goes falling over onto somebody's tent, or falling over while somebody's on the tower adjusting the gamma match on the antenna, I don't have to tell you what would happen. So really think hard about those guy wires. I don't care how strong the tower is, I don't care what the base is. If those guys fail, the tower is going to come down. You'd be amazed how many people don't understand that very simple principle. The real smarts of a radio tower is the guy wires. Make sure they can't, make sure they got flags on them, that people can't run into them at nighttime. Make sure that you got multiple stakes in the ground so that somebody tripping over them can't pull up one of those stakes. Okay, yeah. Let's see. Gordon, you've got it. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
I have another one, W2TCT on the stake issue.
Yeah, go ahead, Gordon.
A couple of things. One, make sure that you put some sort of like survey tape or something on your guy lines so that you're hanging down as streamers so that people don't walk into them. Number two, put like a cut open tennis ball or an old Spalding or something over your stakes so that, you know, people face planting themselves on the end of a stake don't end up being cut open or injured or lose an eye or some other damn thing.
Comment.
Yeah, you got to make sure that those flags or streamers or whatever you put on the guy wires have extremely good visibility. The thing that scares me most is people walking around in the dark, in the middle of the night, to put fuel into the generator or whatever, walking into a stake and onto a guy wire. Now, walking into a guy wire at a slow walk is not so serious, but those stakes have really got to be solid. Make sure that somebody walking into a guy wire can't pull up a stake. Who's the person with the comment?
Run caution tape around the whole area. W2TTT, guy there.
KC2QIQ for a comment for Howie in the inverted V.
You missed two whiskey.
Yeah, go ahead, Gordon. Glenn.
Yeah, actually, just one item that I wanted to mention about inverted Vs. I've done a lot of experimenting with them, and I found that, like, on 80 meters, a center point hold-off at about 67 feet is usually where, like, the optimum performance for an inverted V is on 80 meters. But interestingly enough, as the frequency goes up, in other words, if you want to add other shorter antennas, let's say for 40 meters, 20 meters, and you're working your way up for 10, to think that the mounting point is going to be lower and still get the same performance, it really doesn't seem to work that way. Actually, I think the better bet is that if you really want to set up a nice inverted V, you want to have something like 67 feet, which is pretty considerable, to get really good performance. And then what you want to do is if you have more bands that you want to run, you want to kind of run it like a fan dipole, where you tie it off pretty much at that very, very high 67-foot mark, and then have the higher frequency antennas still up near 67 feet, and then you'll have ideal performance on all those bands. But I don't think you'll ever have good performance tying off like a 10-meter antenna very, very low, close to the ground, if you know what I'm saying, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
QIQ, HWW, with a question.
You got it, Howie. I've got to go away. Bye-bye, you guys. K2RIW, clear.
QIQ. Yeah, have a great weekend, Dick. Great week. QIQ. Well, one, thinking of 67 feet, you know, thinking of putting it on top of a building, let's say a 5- or 6-story building, having the inverted V as high as possible. But as long as you're like a wavelength or two above the ground, that's all you need to be. 67 feet would be a couple of wavelengths for 29 megahertz.
WW2W, just...
Yeah, the other station can pick it up after this. But, Howie, what I've found is that with, like, 10 meters, with inverted Vs, if they're very close to the ground, they just really don't perform. For even a vertical antenna or a dipole, anything less than 40 feet, I don't think the antenna is going to be very effective. Really, to get good DX performance out of an inverted V, I think you really want to be at least above 40 feet. Even at 30 feet, that antenna is going to be pretty limited, I think, if you've experimented a lot in that band.
Okay, yeah, no, I already got it. Tom, it's going to be like on a building. It's not going to be 40 feet above the building, but the overall, the ground of the building up to where it is. Actually, I got one side, it'll be a couple hundred feet above the ground, but it's only like 30 or 40 feet above the roof. But from the ground itself, it would be, at least 70, 80 feet above the ground.
Whiskey to whiskey.
Yeah, whiskey to whiskey. Pick it up after this. But yeah, Howie, I think you'll be fine there because with that kind of elevation, you should be fine. It's just that I've seen sometimes people try inverted Vs and experimenting with them very, very close to the ground level. And of course, the higher frequencies really suffer. And the same thing is true even of vertical antennas. You can use like 80 meter kits and 40 meter kits on vertical antennas right at the ground level, and the performance of those antennas at ground level for 40 and 80 are gangbusters. But as you get to the higher frequency, it's kind of limited, if you know what I'm saying. Let me give it over to that other breaking station, and then Howie gets back over to you. This is KC2 QIQ 73 is all.
Yeah, this is WW2W in UCMS. Ed, we hear you. QIQ, don't go away. I want to say something to you. WW2W, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to get in there right before that ended. If you're still listening, but if you come by the King County Radio Club, you're most welcome. This is Anthony, WW2W. I'm the president of the club at this time. The other thing is, probably the most important thing on field day is communication between the members. In other words, you don't want someone keying up while you're holding the end of a dipole. Things like that, you know. And being careful, mainly probably cords is the most dangerous thing. We had a member 15 years ago who got injured from a bungee cord unraveling, things like that. So anyway, I don't know if Dick is allowed there, but if you're just listening, I would say you're most welcome. Hope to see you there. And if you can, bring that little machine you bought last time that generated electricity. It was a fascinating little device. I think it was a tank crank. Let me see if he's out there. K2RAWWW2W.
I think Dick got out of there. I may be out. I'll be on one of the field days this weekend. Let me vote over QIQ. QIQ, have you played with inverted Vs and dipoles? And what have you found out on 10 meters? I think the inverted V on 10 meters probably works as well or better than a simple dipole. Have you played with an inverted V, QIQ?
Yeah, absolutely, Howie. It's one of my favorite antennas, just short of going into Yagis. As a matter of fact, if I didn't have Yagis and rotators, I'd probably be using inverted Vs, much more than dipoles. Certainly superior to any kind of G5RV or anything like that. As far as 10 meters goes, I think that if your inverted V has got a tie-off point at minimum of 40 feet, it's going to be effective. Now, the key thing is how do you tie it off? And the ends, you don't really want them near anything. So, you know, because the higher frequency the antenna, the further you want it away from obstructions. So that's why I found a lot of times if you had a multi-band antenna, like the 80, 40, 20, maybe you throw a 17 in there, almost like a fan dipole, you know, and just bring it, tailor it down like an inverted V, and you can get a lot of bands on 1 feed line. Very impressive antennas.
SIQ Mobile.
What I'm going to tell you is the antenna is going to be made out of pipe, out of aluminum. You know what it is? It's actually a ham stick. I got an old ham stick from someone, and we're just going to bend the pipe at 45 degrees. So the pipe is going to be supported in the center, but it's going to be rigid enough that it doesn't need to be tied off at the ends. Go ahead, the other station.
Just jumping in and say hello. November 3, Sierra India, Quebec, Mobile 2, out here in Babylon, just making my way west. And, I use a fan dipole in the inverted V format, and I've had tremendous success. It's about 28 meters above the sidewalk on top of an 8-story building, but I love it. It works really well for me. I have played around with a 75-meter hamstick dipole as well. You know, it's kind of like a dummy load, but it works. I've made some small contacts into Europe on that 75-meter hamstick dipole, so just listening in, just got in the car, making my way home from work. Back to you, Howie. This is N3SIQ Mobile 2.
I have some comments about the hamsticks, too.
QIQ, I forgot the name there. I can't believe it. I have a mental block. But let me just say one thing. The antenna I'm going to make that I got already, it's being made out of aluminum T64. It's aluminum, you know, two sections of aluminum with hose clamps. You adjust them. So the antenna doesn't even have to be guide because it's going to be rigid. It's solid aluminum pipe that's connected to an insulator, you know, to a support. And basically this is now a dipole, but I'm going to I'm going to get somebody with a pipe bender and bend the elements 45 degrees. So from element to element, it'll be 90 degrees. So it'll be, you know, it'll be like 45 degrees, 45 degrees from the, 45 degrees from vertical, you know, 45 degrees at an angle. And that's how I'm going to do it. But from element to element, it'll be exactly 90 degrees. Go ahead, QIQ.
Okay, here are a couple of a little bit of things that you may want to keep your eye on with that. So that the hamstick is typically a 50-ohm quarter wave antenna on a ground plane. When they're back-to-back against, in other words, when you have two of them back-to-back, they're not exactly 75, and they're really not 50 ohms anymore. So you kind of have to watch and play with the tuning there a little bit. The other thing is that normally the hamstick wants to be, as I said, on a ground plane and vertical. Now what happens is when you put something in between, you want to make sure that when you're using it in that T configuration or like a V configuration, that the center section is isolated. If you can mount it on a PVC or something like that, but that's going to be pretty flexible. So that's not all that fun either. But really watch the match on that one quite a bit. You might have to play with the match in the center there to really get a good broadband match. But it can be done, Howie. It's just, I think, and it, see, the problem, too, is as you start bending those elements down into the inverted V, I think you're going to see the impedance is even going to drop more, so you might get a little bit more of a mismatch. You might have to play with that a little bit. Howie, by the way, the name is Glenn, and you really have to let me go, so I've got to say 73s, and I'll catch you all you guys down the log. This is KC2 QIQ, 73s for now.
Your phone number again. And an inverted V is close to 50 ohms, 73s.
Howie, it's K2KEY. Give me your home phone number again.
Okay, 718-513-678. You want to give me a call now before I go to sleep?
I have to go to sleep. I have to go to work. 718, and then you dropped out. 5. I guess 718, and then a 5. Over.
718-591-3678.
718-591-3678. I'm going to put this into the rotary, definitely. Okay?
Yeah, no problem. I got parts of an antenna. I got to tell you, I may need a little help with it. I can't physically do it myself. All right, give me a call tomorrow, or whenever you want to, Mel.
You're on the list for tomorrow. Talk to you tomorrow, Howie. Good night.
All right, QIQ, I'll speak to you later on. But a straight-out dipole is 75 ohms, yes, and I'm very familiar with the... I'm not using hamstick. Those hamstick mounts... this is not a hamstick. This is the old trick stick from Chris Crafts. But the hamsticks, the whole mount... One side of the mount is ground, and that, yes, you have to isolate that. A lot of people don't isolate that from a pipe, and that would create a problem. But an inverted V is a 50-ohm antenna. That's what's great about it. A dipole 75 ohms, and an inverted V is close to 50 ohms.
Yeah, very good, Howie. It's just that I'm thinking what happens a lot of times in an inverted V, because the impedance goes down from naturally where those antennas want to be, either in the vertical or, you know, across the T length, that sometimes the bandwidth might get a little... You know, just keep your eye on it. As long as you have a good antenna analyzer before you put it in position, I think you're going to be okay. But have a good one there, Howie. Let me say 73s for now. KC2, QIQ. Gone for good this time. Have a good one. Bye now.
All right, I got to go also. WB2HWW. 73s, everybody have a great field day. Good week. We'll be around next week.
Good night, Howie. Good night, Glenn. N3SIQ Mobile 2, Farmingdale.
KE2EJ, KE2EJ, K2YO.
Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1714 with a release date of Friday, June 18th, 2010. To follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST, Amateur Radio gets ready for the 2010 Scouting Jamboree. Hams assist as floods hit Arkansas and tornadoes hit Ohio. And a balloon ride across the English Channel gets tracked using APRS. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1714, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent, on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting from Reno, Nevada, here is Don Carlson, KQ6 FM.
The 2010 National Scout Jamboree is a little more than a month away. This year's theme is the celebration of 100 years of scouting in the United States, and ham radio will be an important part of the festivities. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, is at our East Coast Bureau with more.
For anyone who's ever been or still is a Boy Scout, youth, or leader, celebrating an anniversary of this significance is truly a once-in-a-lifetime happening. And why not do it with a huge campout or jamboree at a military base called Fort A.P. Hill, Virginia, just outside of Woodbridge? Of course, to make it really a special event, you set up an amateur radio station. The staff of K2BSA, the call sign of the Boy Scouts of America, is making final preparations for the event, which runs from July 26th through August 4th. Ed Dudley, WA4ISI, is the volunteer coordinator for the K2BSA staff. He says the staff of nearly 50 volunteers is made up of folks from a variety of fields who will be coming from all around the country.
We have doctors and lawyers. We have scientists, engineers, and we have youth that are scouts that will be part of the staff.
Among the youth, Andrew Koenig, KE5GDB, Amateur Radio Newsline's 2009 Young Ham of the Year. Dudley says the centerpiece of the K2BSA operation is a large demonstration station located inside a circus-style tent with HF and VHF stations set up, a temporary antenna farm that might rival some of the smaller DX operations, and plans in the works for a contact with one of the astronauts aboard the International Space Station. But Dudley says that's not all.
We'll also be doing the Radio Merit Badge at the Merit Badge Midway, and we have a third group that will be doing licensing and testing. We'll have classes and give the test every evening that there's not an arena show. When they have the arena shows, everything shuts down. But every other night, we'll have testing for the amateur radio licenses, all levels.
Dudley says the mission of the K2BSA staff is clear, showing off the best of amateur radio.
Well, we have an opportunity here to show ham radio to lots of scouts. And when I say lots, I mean lots. There are approximately 40,000 scouts and adults that are actual participants in the Jamboree, plus there's 6,000 or 7,000 staff members. All of these people can come in and see what's going on. But beyond that, there may be several hundred thousands of visitors.
At the K2BSA demonstration station, Dudley says the idea is to get scouts and visitors talking on the air with other scouts around the country and around the world.
I'd like to see scouts from all over the world that can come into to a local ham station and make a contact and talk to some of these guys at the Jamboree. That's what the demonstration station is. It's sort of like Jamboree on the air in that we're trying to do contacts with other scouts. Of course, we talk to everyone else, too.
The bottom line, Dudley would love to see the ham community get active during the Jamboree. And, of course, if you contact K2BSA, there's a nice little bonus.
Get on your radio and give us a call. If you'd like a QSL card, we'll have a unique QSL card for the Jamboree. We do ask that you send an SASE along with that, because we may make thousands of contacts. And we'd love to send you a card, but we can't afford to pay for the mailing for all of them.
Check out the July QST cover story by Bill Marine, N2COP, to learn more about K2BSA's operations at the National Jamboree. And listen for the web address at the end of this story, too. Your humble correspondent will be part of the K2BSA staff for the third time in my scouting career. I hope to be able to file a story or two for the Amateur Radio Newsline while there. For now, for the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V, in Philadelphia.
More information on this year's Scout Jamboree is online at www.nsj2010ham.com. Ham Radio was called out on June 6th to assist in the search for missing people following flooding in the Albert Pike Campground about 75 miles west of Little Rock, Arkansas. Despite temporary cell phone towers being installed, emergency personnel still needed help communicating in the remote Arkansas wilderness. Because of this, local law enforcement has requested the help of ham radio operators across the state. The Central Arkansas Ultra High Frequency Amateur Radio Club is quick to respond. Its spokesman, Josh Carroll, N5JLC. He says cell phones can only cover so much of an area. According to Carroll, the cellular towers and services that have been put in place are functioning properly. The problem is they're working for a certain portion of the affected area, and the area we're currently concerned with is still very spotty as far as cellular service and communications. So that's why they requested assistance of the ham radio community. The flash flood swept through a popular Arkansas campground on Friday, June 4th. At least 19 people have been confirmed killed, and one person is still missing after sudden severe floods rampaged through the area. The ARRL reports that during the overnight hours of Saturday, June 5th through Sunday, June 6th, severe weather and tornadoes ripped across an area of northwestern Ohio, laying a large path of destruction. Aries and Skywarn groups in Erie, Huron, Sandusky, and Wood counties activated nets as early as 10:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on the 5th, with many not standing down until 4:30 a.m. the next day. According to ARRL Ohio Section Manager Frank Piper, KIHGW, traffic on the nets was filled with reports of severe weather damage, flooding, and down power lines.
I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, with breaking news. Dateline, Norwich, Connecticut, where a ham arrested last month on charges he called in a fake report of a gunman at a Walmart is in custody again, this time on a charge of suspicion of arson linked to a 2007 fire. According to the Norwich Bulletin online newspaper, Keith Mutch, KB1RVI, was arrested Wednesday, June 16th, on a warrant charging him with second-degree arson and first-degree criminal mischief in connection with the June 7, 2007 fire at a vacant home in Norwich. No injuries were reported in the blaze. Mutch was also charged with tampering with a witness for actions connected to his May 28th arrest on charges that he used two-way radio on January 26th to call in reports of an armed man threatening to shoot people outside a Walmart in the city of Norwich. Police say that they developed information that Mutch had contacted one witness in the Walmart incident and tried to convince her to change her testimony. Mutch was arraigned on Thursday, June 17th, in Norwich Superior Court. He's being held on a total of $325,000 in bonds. Norwich Police Lieutenant Stephanie Bakulis said that the investigation into the suspicious fires is ongoing and more arrests are expected. You can read more online at tinyurl.com/2FFEE7H. From the newsroom, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, in the City of Angels.
A federal judge sentenced Curtis Thorstedt of Salinas, California, to 30 months in federal prison, this after the 53-year-old pleaded guilty in July in U.S. District Court in San Jose to broadcasting a fake distress signal in October of 2008. At that time, he made transmissions, Thorstedt told would-be rescuers, in that he was at a kayak off the coast of Santa Cruz and having difficulty getting to shore. However, it was found that he was actually at his home in the city of Salinas. Thorstedt also pleaded guilty in October to making two other fake Mayday calls to the Coast Guard. In all, the court found that Thorstedt has made 51 false distress messages over 6 months and costing the Coast Guard $102,000 in search and related costs. This is not the first time that Thorstedt has been convicted of transmitting a false distress message. In April 2004, he was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison and ordered to pay more than $29,000 in restitution to the Coast Guard for a similar series of hoax calls. And in one of the earlier incidents, Thorstedt's phony call interrupted a real distress call from a 33-foot boat 4 miles off the coast of Santa Cruz Island. More on this story is online at tinyurl.com/2163OQ8. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the N9 AKN repeater serving Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The 2009 IARU contest between the world's National Amateur Radio Society headquarters stations has produced a bitter dispute over the scores. This is an argument rages between the Spanish and German national societies over who actually finished in first place, as the ARRL says that nobody will be declared to have taken first place. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, has the details.
Dave Patton, NN1N, is the manager, ARRL Membership and Volunteer Programs. In a June 7th statement for the ARRL Awards Committee regarding headquarters station entries in the 2009 IARU HF World Championship, he writes that a most unfortunate dispute has arisen, this between AO8HQ on behalf of Spain's Union de Radio Aficionados Españoles, or URE, and DA0HQ on behalf of the Deutscher Amateur Radio Club, or DARC. Patton says that as the administrator of the contest on behalf of the IARU, the ARRL regrets that it has contributed to this development in two ways. He says that far too much emphasis has been allowed to develop on competition between headquarters station entries. He explains the special category of headquarters stations was intended to raise the visibility of the IARU member societies among active radio amateurs and to make the contest more interesting to participants by providing additional multipliers. But, says Patton, it was never intended to be a competition for the highest world score. Clearly, there can never be a level playing field for such competition, nor does it further the objectives of the IARU. Second, in adjudicating the 2009 contest results, a serious error was made in the initial computation of scores. He explains that many contacts were incorrectly identified as busted calls that were not. As a result of this error, when the results were first published, AOHAQ was shown as having the highest score, when in fact DA0HQ's score, after correction of the computation, is slightly higher. Therefore, the ARRL Awards Committee has decided that no certificate will be awarded to the high-scoring IARU Member Society HQ station in 2009. Instead, a certificate will be awarded to each continent leader, and certificates of appreciation for their participation will be awarded to all headquarters stations. And there are major changes coming to get the event back on track. Effective with the 2010 IARU HF World Championship, no adjudication of HQ station logs will be conducted by the ARRL. A certificate of participation will be awarded to each IARU member society headquarters station, and that will be it. Also affected with the 2010 event, by submitting a log, the submitter agrees that the log may be made public at the discretion of the contest sponsor. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
In the committee statement, Patton says that the ARRL will not engage in any further correspondence with regard to the 2009 IARU HF World Championship, but it does welcome suggestions for improvements for future events. The ARRL Awards Committee statement can be seen online at tinyurl.com/3xfo54h. The FCC has issued a forfeiture order in the amount of $4,500 to Mark Neiman and Kakadu Productions. This for willfully and repeatedly violating Section 301 of the Communications Act of 1934 by operating an unlicensed radio station on the frequency 99.9 megahertz in Brooklyn, New York. The investigation revolving this matter goes back almost 9 months. In response to several complaints from licensed area broadcasters, on October 12th and 13th of 2009, an agent from the Enforcement Bureau's New York office used a mobile direction finding vehicle and determined that the source of broadcast transmissions on 99.9 megahertz was a radio station operating from an apartment building located in Brooklyn's Coney Island area. The agent also observed an FM broadcast antenna on top of a water tank on the roof of the apartment building. The agent subsequently took field strength measurements and determined that the signals being broadcast exceeded the limits for operation under Part 15 of the Commission's rules and therefore required a license. After taking the measurements, the agent went to the office of the building management company. The office's director stated that he was aware of the antenna and that a 5-year lease had been executed between Luna Park and Mark Neiman of Kakadu Productions, allowing a radio station to operate in the bulkhead room of the structure. Accompanied by the building superintendent, the agent then returned and conducted an inspection of the FM broadcast antenna on top of a water tank. The agent observed coaxial cable connecting the antenna to the radio station equipment located inside the bulkhead room. The agent also observed that the radio station equipment was active and recorded information about the apparatus. The building superintendent then shut down all of the equipment at the agent's request. On January 8, 2010, the New York office issued a notice of apparent liability for forfeiture in the amount of $10,000 to Neiman and Kakadu for apparently willfully and repeatedly operating an unlicensed radio station. Neiman and Kakadu jointly submitted a response on February 9th. In it, Neiman and Kakadu did not dispute the violations identified in the NAL, but request cancellation of the proposed forfeiture based on their inability to pay. In support of their claim of financial hardship, Neiman and Kakadu submitted 3 years of individual and corporate tax returns. After reviewing the documentation, the FCC concluded that a reduction of the forfeiture to $4,500 is warranted. Neiman and Kakadu were given the customary 30 days to pay the fine or file a further appeal. Distracted driving should be treated as a medical condition. So says Dr. Amy Schiff, a primary care physician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, who suggests it's time for physicians to talk to patients about driving while distracted. Dr. Schiff says that distracted driving is a problem that has risen to the rough equivalence of drunken driving, thanks to the proliferation of phones that allow drivers to talk and text. Writing in the June 10th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, Schiff notes that physicians routinely ask patients about habits associated with potential harm, like the use of helmets, seatbelts, cigarettes, drugs, and alcohol. And with the data showing 28% of all accidents in the United States are caused by drivers talking on cell phones or texting, it's time to step into this issue too. While the absolute increase in the risk of collision attributable to distracted drivers is hard to assess, Schiff says one study showed talking and driving posed a 4-time greater risk than undistracted driving. A second study suggested texting raised the risk of collision by a factor of 23. You can read the entire article on Dr. Schiff's work at tinyurl.com/25BBT55. Echolink is now available for your iPhone, free of charge from Apple's App Store. Echolink for iPhone is an addition to the Echolink software that runs on an iPhone or iPod Touch. If you own one of these devices and are a validated Echolink user, you can access the Echolink system from nearly anywhere Wi-Fi networking is available. If you have an iPhone, you can also use it to access Echolink over the cellular data network. You can get this application online at tinyurl.com/2BZPPRO. The Icelandic National Amateur Radio Society has a new executive committee. Its members are TF2JB as president, TF3EE as vice president, TF3UA is the secretary, with TF3G as treasurer. The new IARU liaison is TF3KB. The election to these positions took place at the 2010 General Assembly of the Society that took place on May 22nd in the city of Reykjavik. AMSAT has announced that its 2010 Space Symposium and annual meeting will be held on Friday, October 8th through Sunday, October 10th. This year's venue is the Chicago at Elk Grove Holiday Inn, which is near O'Hare Airport for the event. This is the same hotel that recently has hosted the Central States VHF Conference and W9DXCC events. AMSAT has also put out a call for papers to be presented at the symposium. These can be on any topic of interest to the amateur satellite community. A final copy must be submitted by September 1st for inclusion in the printed proceedings. Abstracts and papers should be sent via email to k9jkm@amsat.org. And as a reminder, for the 10th consecutive year, the call sign N6R will operate as a field day station from the grounds of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California. This to commemorate the lives of President Ronald and Mrs. Nancy Reagan. Joining the Ventura County Amateur Radio Society, which is the primary organizer, will be a number of other local groups. These include the Angan Amateur Radio Club, the Caneo Valley Amateur Radio Club, the Simi Settlers Amateur Radio Club, the Ventura County Amateur Radio Club, and the Hollywood Hills QRP Contest Club. N6R will operate from 1800 UTC on June 25th to 1800 UTC on June 27th, with up to 16 stations on all of the high-frequency bands. Also, listen out for the N6R call on the VHF and UHF bands from 6 meters on up using many modes, including FastCan ATV and satellite operations. If you're lucky enough to make contact with N6R this year, please QSL with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Ventura County Amateur Radio Society in care of Peter Hines, N6ZE, 1559 Norwich Avenue, Thousand Oaks, California, 91360. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org, and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following Radio Amateur. unsuccessfully crossed the English Channel using helium-filled party balloons. Jonathan Trapp, KJ4GQV, recently strapped himself to 54 balloons and floated across the English Channel. Tied to an assortment of red, green, yellow, blue, and white balloons, the 36-year-old Trapp is from Raleigh, North Carolina, made his trip across the channel on May 28. KJ4GQV took off from a field at the Kent Lighting Club near Ashford in the UK and landed at 7:42 UTC in a farmer's vegetable patch a few miles from Dunkirk, France. To make his flight, KJ4GQV was strapped in a specially equipped chair below a bright cluster of balloons. About 5 hours later, he lowered himself into a French field by cutting some of the balloons away. His equipment list didn't stop at balloons and a chair. It also included an aircraft transponder, aircraft radios, emergency locator beacon, in-flight satellite tracking, and an oxygen system. He also carried APRS gear that provided real-time tracking of his KJ4GQV call sign via his website. Kraft says crossing wasn't a matter of just grabbing a few balloons. Rather, KJ4GQV says on his website that he made the trip in March to gain clearance from French and British aviation authorities. He also gained permits for the trip from customs and immigration offices on both sides. Jonathan Trapp, KJ4GQV, is no stranger to balloon flights. 2 months ago, he claimed the record for the longest free-floating balloon flight. This after spending 14 hours cruising over North Carolina and traveling 109 miles. On another flight, his website says, he ascended to 17,930 feet just below controlled airspace. You can read more online at www.clusterballoon.com. What is believed to be the first amateur radio two-way contact on 8.97 kHz using truly radiated fields took place on Friday, June 4, 2010, between DJ2LF and DF6NM. The distance was over a 20.2 kilometer path. Both DJ2LF and DF6NM were using small backyard Marconi antennas for transmit and receive. DJ2LF's antenna had an estimated effective height of about 5 meters, while DF6NM was about 7 meters. Both had an effective radiated power of about 5 microwatts, using a 100-watt car radio amplifier as a transmitter. A computer and sound card with no preamplifiers served each station as a receiver. Both stations employed a special micro-QSO format. This system is designed to exchange the minimum signal bit report and confirmation in only 3 turnovers, each containing a single dash. Station identification was by frequency alone. A new crew with 2 licensed U.S. hams will soon be on board the International Space Station. Set to go on orbit are U.S. astronauts Douglas Wheelock, KF5BOC, and Shannon Walker, KD5DXB. They will be joined by Russia's Fyodor Yuchurkin, RN3FI, on for a mission lasting about 6 months. Wheelock, Walker, and Yuchurkin will arrive on Russian Soyuz booster launched on June 15th. They'll be on board the orbiting space station when the final shuttle flight of a United States space shuttle departs from its last planned mission to the lab in November before the fleet is finally retired. That flight will use the shuttle Endeavour. The new 3-person crew will join Russian Commander Alexander Skvortsov, NASA flight engineer Tracy Caldwell Dyson, and Russia's Mikhail Kornienko, who have been on the orbiting laboratory since April and are set to return to Earth shortly. A Russian Progress cargo carrier is also due to arrive at the orbiting lab later this month. 5 videos from the 2010 AmSTAT Forum at the Dayton Hamvention can now be viewed online. The complete presentations are now available on the AmSTAT website at http://www.amstat.org. From the menu on the left side of the homepage, select AmSTAT Video News. The Paper Aircraft Released into Space, or PARIS project, has made public more information and pictures of their space GPS unit. The output from the GPS is formatted into amateur radio standard AX25 APRS data packets and transmitted using audio frequency ship keying. This means that it can be decoded by an amateur radio receiver tuned to 433.950 MHz and connected to a PC via the sound card. More is online at tinyurl.com/2WH5DZD. On the air, the 2010 National Wildlife Refuge Week is set for October 10th to the 16th, and amateur radio will again be helping to mark this event. Amateur radio observation will take place between Saturday, October 9th and Sunday, October 17th, with stations expected to operate from several national wildlife refuges. Contacts made with 5 special refuge stations listed as active sites will earn a special certificate. For more information, contact the National Wildlife Refuge Week Amateur Radio Coordinator by email to info@nwrweek-radio.info. More details are online at www.nwrweek-radio.info. NDX, the long-anticipated Spratly Island de-expedition slated for January of 2011. This, according to VK3FY, has just returned from the Philippines, where he held high-level discussions related to the upcoming DX-0DX operation. The series of meetings included one with current municipal mayor of Ditu Island, where the de-expedition will be mounted. Another was held with the mayor-designate, who will take office in September. Other discussions were held with military authorities, plus officials of the Philippines Amateur Radio Association, which is strongly in support of the de-expedition. VK3FY says that those face-to-face discussions enabled the amateur radio and humanitarian aims of the de-expedition to be fully explained and agreed. It also clarified the requirements of both local and federal authorities. The operation will last 3 weeks and require upward of 30 operators. Bill Moore, NC1L, ARRL Awards Branch Manager, reports that 2010 E4X operation from Palestine operation will now be accepted for DXCC credit. If you work this operation, the QSL route is via EA5RM. JACNL will be active as KH0N from Salapan between June 18th through the 22nd. His operation will include the All-Asian DXCW contest on June 19th and 20th. Outside the contest, he will spend some time on 80, 30, 17, and 12-meter bands operating only Morse, USL via his home call sign. VE2ZIK will be active from Belize and the Croatian coast between July 1st and September 27th as 9A/VE3ZIK. He will try to activate several IOTA islands in the EU-170 group, as well as take part in the RSGB Islands on the Air or IOTA contest. QSL via DO7ZZ. Lastly, VE3EY will be active as Portable FJ from St. Barthélemy Island from November 22nd to the 30th. Operation will be on 160 through 10 meters using CW, SSB, and RTTY. QSL via his home call sign. 4 members of Yamegdo Amateur Radio Club will be active from Yap Island in Micronesia between June 22nd and the 29th. The team will bring 5 transmitters and 1 500-watt amplifier with plans to operate 160 through 6 meters using CW, SSB, and RTTY. They will be on the air 24 hours operating at least 2 bands and a 6-meter beacon, but with a maximum 5 bands operating as time permits. This is their 19th de-expedition since 1993. Please QSL as directed on the air. And finally this week, word that the world's biggest radio telescope has been established in the Netherlands. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, takes a look at its very unusual design.
Scientists in the Netherlands have revealed the largest radio telescope in the world while claiming that it is capable of detecting faint signals from almost as far back as the Big Bang that many believe created the universe. Called LOFAR, L-O-F-A-R, it's an acronym that stands for Low Frequency Array. Its owner is the Netherlands Radio Astronomy Institute, which says that its construction is very unique. Instead of the traditional large dish, the new telescope is made up of 25,000 small antennas measuring between 50 centimeters and 2 meters across. The main unit is based near the northern Dutch town of Assen, but the antennas are spread out across the rest of the Netherlands and also into Germany, Sweden, France, and Britain. When you combine all the antennas, you get a giant telescope with a diameter of, get this, 1,000 kilometers or about 600 miles. A unique design for the modern times we live in. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. I'm in the newsroom in the City of Angels.
The data gathered by the telescope will be processed by a supercomputer at the University of Groningen, then transmitted to the Netherlands Radio Astronomy Institute. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, Southgate News, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, at the editor's desk, I'm Don Carlson, KQ6FM in Reno, Nevada, saying 7-3, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2010, all rights reserved.
Tonight at 8 o'clock, WQVL repeater system.